What's going on, podcast listeners? Neil here for another episode of the Freedom Formula. I am pumped for today's guest, John Cypher. How you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So John is the author of a book called Output Thinking, which we're going to talk about soon. He also runs something called CEO Bootcamp, and he's had, I believe, 23 or 25 businesses over the course of his career.
No, not that many, but I've had a number of them.
So John, I'm pumped to talk with you and talk about your journey over here. I believe your first business, if I'm correct, in the 70s, was a waterbed store. Is that right?
Yes. It was the first
That's
one
so
and
funny.
The only one that failed miserably.
How'd you, let's start there. I'm super curious on your journey. How'd you even get started in that?
Okay. A friend of mine was a manager of a waterbed store, and the guy who had it wanted to franchise, and so he approached my friend and said, "You want to open up a franchise?" And so he and two and me and somebody else, three buddies, said, "Yeah, sure. This sounds like a great idea."
Yeah.
We didn't know anything that we were doing. We didn't know anything about retail. We didn't know how to manage a partnership. It was just terrible. I said later, the only person that made money was the manager that we hired, and we would have done it better by just finding some random guy on the street and said, "Here's a bunch of money. Go away."
Yeah. So how big were waterbeds back then?
Like, waterbeds were a thing. This was in the 70s.
Yeah.
And waterbeds were a thing. My dad actually lent me some money to do this, and then thankfully forgave the loan. But he got a fancy waterbed for all his efforts.
Yeah. have you seen when you spot things now which are trendy, like I don't know if waterbeds would be considered a trend or like it lasted a good enough time to be able to franchise.
Oh yeah, it was definitely a trend. Yeah.
Okay. So when you see things now, do you think like, yep, history's repeating itself? This is the exact trend. It's going to go up and go down. Or how do you see things now?
Well, mostly in the consumer space, almost everything's a trend. You know, fashion clothes are a trend. The kinds of cars that happen are a trend. Pet Rocks, which also I think was from the 70s in America, mm-hmm. is now coming back in Korea. So it's like an actual rock that's instead of a Tamagotchi, if you remember those, which
yep.
was an electronic pet that you didn't do anything, you know, that you played with. All this stuff comes and goes. And if you want to invest in it or be part of it, you have to get in at the right time and you have to do it well and you have to hopefully not sink all of your life savings into it, because
yeah.
if it does go away, it goes away. And I didn't know any of that at the time. I just thought, hey, business is business, you know, but it's,
yeah.
there's a big difference between selling to consumers and selling to businesses.
Interesting. John, curious what you think about with B2B versus B2C, which is business to business, businesses or business to consumer, especially because I feel like you've done both sides. And just to set the stage, a lot of listeners are maybe starting to get an entrepreneurship. Maybe it's the first thing, or they have a business right now and they want to make it scale a little bit more. And a lot of them wondering what's the best business model. And from what you've seen, how would you kind of define what you like to look into?
Well, the best business is one that you can sell something that people want to buy
mm-hmm.
and do it for less money than they want to pay you and do it over and over again.
Full.
So it is very simple. It's not easy.
Yeah.
And how that applies to any particular person depends on their skills and their abilities and their the amount they have to invest in terms of time and money. There's a formula in the gambling world, which I don't bet, but it's called the Kelly method or something like that. And it calculates based on the chance of winning and how much money you have, how much you should bet. And the trick is, and this is true, this part is true in business, you don't want to bet so much that if you lose, you're out of the game.
Yeah.
And so if people have never been an entrepreneur before, my recommendation is do something on the side. Do something that you can sell, which usually means selling your time, selling some skill that you have. It's cheap to get into. The hard part is selling, and that's what you have to learn. In any business, you have to learn that. So if you can try that and not fail catastrophically, then then you can live to play another day. And then if your side hustle ends up paying you more than your regular gig and you want to jump ship, that's a good time to jump ship.
So your philosophy is do something on the side, almost level yourself up, so then you can play a bigger game with more skills. Is that kind of a good summary?
Yeah. And if you make money, particularly if it is on the side and you don't need that money to live, use that to reinvest. Use that to hire people. Use that to get better marketing. The other trick as an entrepreneur, especially if you're young, I guess this works if you're either young or old, but not in the middle. keep your lifestyle costs low. And so it's great to do in your 20s if you're not married, if you don't have kids, if you don't have a house, because you're flexible. And the worst that can happen is you lose a bunch of money. But you have your time and, you know, you haven't lost your house. You haven't lost your wife and kids, that kind of thing. And keep that in mind, because it's true. Most businesses fail. And you don't want to be on the catastrophic end of that failure.
Yeah. It's interesting because with Made This Franchise, I do a lot of franchise vetting calls. And after I've done like hundreds of them at this point, and I could kind of tell he's going to make the plunge or not. And I feel like the people who are in the toughest position, oddly enough, are not people who are like super stressed, don't know what to do, hate their job. Those aren't the people. The people who are in the toughest position are typically maybe 35 years old, have a wife, a couple kids, have a job that they don't hate. You know, they make 100 grand, they make good money, they're not really fulfilled in. And I could just tell when they hop on a call, you know, they say, hey, I want to make 100 grand before I even consider leaving my job, but I only have nights and weekends to work. And it's kind of like, hey, you're stuck in a really tough position at this point, because I don't want to call it golden handcuffs, because it's not like you're making a ton of money, but your life's not bad enough to say, hey, I'm going to reset, you know? And it's kind of like what you said, if you're really young or much older, you don't have to deal with that because there's less responsibility, there's less opportunity cost to give up. But for a lot of people, it's really tough, right? And I do think people can still take the plunge and dive into it, but it requires some more cojones to do that at that stage.
And in that case, it definitely requires a supportive spouse and somebody who hopefully has a job with health insurance and so can support you through all that stuff. Is that something somebody could start nights and weekends or no?
Yeah, I think it depends on their level of business expertise. I've had people do that, but they typically hire managers. They know what they're doing, things like that. I always say it's best if you're working from home, if you have hours throughout the day to do it, because it's really tough at the beginning to do nights and weekends. Later on, you could do that. At the beginning, it's going to be kind of tough.
Yeah, especially because any business is in business to serve a customer, and you have to serve when the customers are willing to be served.
Yeah.
And if they're not willing to be served nights and weekends, it's hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
John, I'm curious on your thoughts on this. I know a large part of your philosophy is building a business like an asset, like something that's an investment, thinking about it that way, as opposed to just an immediate cash cow. When you think about that versus like businesses which might be trendy, waterbeds or crumble cookies or whatever, how do you think about trend-based businesses which are like exploding, people want to get into it, but also having a business like an asset?
Well, I don't think they're necessarily counterintuitive or mutually exclusive, but I think the difference of it is if you are working, you know, Michael Gerber coined this phrase, work on your business, not in your business, which is kind of oversimplistic. Until your business is multiple millions of dollars, you have to work both, you know, but the difference is if you're working in your business, basically you are doing customer facing work. You're making the stuff that customers want to buy, or you're making the service they want to buy, and you're selling. When you're working on your business, you're working internally. You're working on employees, on workflows, on making the employees do better. And you generally at that point have somebody to do the selling and to do the production work. That business is more of an asset, because you could pull away from it easier and sell it, and the customers wouldn't know that you left. They wouldn't know there was a new manager. And that makes it more of an asset that you can sell separately. Otherwise, it's a good living, and it can be, in many cases, very lucrative. Nothing wrong with that. I call that a stage one company, where the person at the top is doing customer facing work.
Yeah.
And depending on the industry and the market, you can make a lot of money doing that. It's not something that you can easily sell because so much of it depends on you. But when you can systemize it and you can make what you do repeatable and put somebody else in charge of that aspect of it, then it becomes an asset. And that's really, that was part of the genesis for my book, Output Thinking, was I started seeing this. The other piece that you and I haven't talked about is after I moved 1,500 miles away from my company, which was not the waterbed store, I had time because I had systemized that company so where it didn't need me on a day-to-day basis. And I got into coaching. Somebody who I used to work with said, you should look into this. You know, you'd be good. I said, what's that? It hadn't become a buzzword. Mm-hmm. And I started coaching other business owners. And one of the main frustrations that I had as a business owner and that my clients have had is a disconnect between what you expect employees to do and what they actually do. Mm-hmm. And what I realized was people, particularly on both sides of that equation, have an understanding, an assumption about the job title. And the job title is really a shortcut for what you hire somebody to produce. And what they produce is what I call outputs. And so if you think about the title marketing director, well, in some cases, that person actually produces social media posts, they produce speeches or things like that. In other companies, the person with the same title produces a budget and produces strategy and manages a team that does all the other stuff. Right. And that's a kind of an extreme example, but when there's a disconnect, that's where frustration is. And what I say in the book is that you hire people to produce outputs. And if you can delineate exactly what those outputs are supposed to look like and get your employees to understand that and agree, then that makes managing them so much easier. The other thing that it allows you to do is it allows you to detach from their job description or their job title the actual outputs that you want them to produce. And you may find somebody who's got, you know, six or seven different outputs because we're all doing lots of different things in a company.
Yeah.
And maybe they're great at five of them. And there's somebody else who has a totally unrelated job title who's great at those other two. We'll move them. Just say, oh, let's put this on your job title now. You know, not necessarily your title, but your responsibility. And it makes hiring much easier when you can be upfront. These are the outputs we're going to expect from you. It makes managing easier. It makes performance reviews easier. And then the next step to that, which gets back to your question about the asset, the way those outputs are produced is usually one of two ways. Either somebody who's got experience, intuition, they just get in there and do it, or somebody who is following a system.
Yeah.
The system is much more repeatable, much more scalable, makes the company much more valuable. I liken the difference between you have grandma in the kitchen who makes great food, doesn't have follow a recipe.
Yeah.
Holiday meals are wonderful. It's a great output, but there's no process. And you can't scale up a restaurant with grandmas. They're hard to find and they're very expensive, you know. But when you break it down into a recipe, now we can break this out. Oh, you do this, the prep part. You do this part. You do that part. And now it's scalable. And those systems are what makes it scalable. Developing those systems is what I call working on your business.
Yeah. So, John, one thing I'm confused about with this, maybe not confused about, but I'm trying to solve. Let's say we use output thinking. We say, hey, I'm going to hire someone in sales for my local cleaning company. Your job's getting $1,000, $1,500 in sales per day. Now, that does not hit. The excuse that would come back is, I don't have enough leads.
Right.
So sometimes what I found is if I do output thinking, saying, here's the result, it's dependent on another department. And that department's dependent on another department. And so it kind of goes like, hey, who's taking ownership over this? How's this actually going to work? And then you understand that, these are kind of interrelated. You can't really blame one person for not hitting their outputs. How do you think about that?
Well, I think of it in terms of, actually, that's a system that has subdivided into two subsystems. One is producing leads, and that's the output of the generally called the marketing department.
Right.
Or the marketing systems. then those leads are the input into sales.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a company is very small, the person who's doing that is probably doing all of that.
Yep.
They're finding the leads, they're generating interest, they're qualifying the leads, they're making the proposals, they're closing the deals.
Mm-hmm.
As the company gets big, those systems subdivide. And you have one person or one team that's really good at generating good leads. And that's all they do. And they get rewarded for that. And they feed those into the other system, which is closing. And so you would reward each system slightly different, or the people in each system slightly differently. So you would reward the salespeople perhaps for their closing ratio. In other words, what percentage of leads they close. If they didn't have good leads, that's not their responsibility anymore.
Yep.
And so you can't judge them just on the closing, but you can on the percentage.
Got it. And John, if people are having a younger business, let's say it's just the owner, maybe they hired one global talent, and they're listening to this and thinking, hey, how do I start implementing the foundations correctly from now? So when I do scale, a lot of the stuff John says, it's already baked in. How would you advise a brand new business or a smaller business to start inputting output thinking and these types of processes and systems from the beginning?
You mentioned they've hired a global support person. In a sense, they've already done that, because when you hire somebody, particularly as a contractor, you have to define what's in a contract generally called scope of work. What do you expect them to do? That's the definition of outputs. I want you to generally offshore people are used for generating leads, and sometimes the entire sale, if the sale can be done over the phone or over email, doesn't have to be done in person. So there's two systems right there. They're also useful for some of the back office stuff, bookkeeping, accounts payable, accounts receivable, things like that. And those can all be quantified and defined in terms of outputs. Then the other person in this fictional company we're talking about, what do? Do they go out and clean the customer's place? Do they go out and make proposals? They can start thinking about all the different things. They order supplies, I imagine. Mm-hmm. They check that the supplies came in properly. They think about all the things they do and say, okay, at what point do I need to hire somebody to produce those outputs?
Yep. Got it. Gotcha. Okay.
So,
John, with kind of going back to business models and what you've been saying, and you've coached a lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of the one question I had is, hey, what's the most common issue you see? And I feel like it's going to be what output thinking hopefully solves. But besides that, I think when people are earlier in their business, I'm curious what other problems you might see that, you know, they might pick the wrong business model. They might think about things a certain way, especially if they're new to business. I'm curious what you've seen.
One thing is, they don't understand all the other parts. If they just came out of a job and they've never run a business, they don't understand all the other parts that go into making a product into a business. So you see this a lot. Somebody who's a great cook, and people say, oh, you should open a restaurant. No, you shouldn't.
Yeah.
The person who's the good cook is not spending most of their time cooking if it's a successful restaurant.
Yeah.
They have to find a place. They have to rent it. They have to hire people. They have to train people. They have to make the menus. They have to, you know, they have to do all kinds of things that have nothing to do with cooking. And if they don't like that or can't learn that, they're going to be in trouble. So that's one piece. The other piece is, when people are good at what they do or reasonably successful, they tend to be intuitive. And they tend to be quick and fast moving and get stuff done. And then they reach a point where it's hard to get this stuff out of their heads. It's the grandma in the kitchen. No recipe. Yep. Nobody else can cook like me. Well, that's true. Let's get that stuff out of your head into a recipe. Figure out what you do. That is hard for intuitive people. And one of the techniques to doing that is to think through very, very slowly what it is you do and how you do it. So let's just talk about, you know, in a cleaning service. Somebody walks into a room, needs to be cleaned. They can look around and immediately know what needs to be cleaned, what's dirty, what's not dirty, what was done right last time, what wasn't done. How do they know that? they have to slow their mind down and say, wait a minute, do I look from left to right, top to bottom? Do I start at the floor? Do I start at the windows? And every time in that process, that person says, okay, here's how I make a judgment about what do I need to do with the desk or the bed or the whatever.
Yeah.
When you reach that judgment point, that's where you stop and say, oh, is this a new system or is this a refinement that I can train somebody else to how to have the same judgment? Bless you. And so when you see that in yourself, if you can slow it down and get that recipe out of your head, then you can start hiring people to say, oh, either the recipe is so complete, I can hire somebody to do the whole thing, or I can't get somebody to do the whole thing, but I can get them up to this part, and then they can turn it over to me. Then I can spend my days just doing this part. And there's an example of that of a guy in Pittsburgh, actually, years ago, who's a surgeon called Freddie Fu, recently passed away. But he started this process of having two operating rooms simultaneously. And he was he would just go in, he would have another staff that would prepare the patient, open them up. He would come in, do the magic that he needed to do, and then go clean up, go to the other operating room where another patient was ready for him. Somebody else would close the patient up and get them rehabilitated. And by doing that, he couldn't replace himself, but he could replace all the stuff that wasn't absolutely critical for him.
Yep. Yeah. It's so interesting because I think what most entrepreneurs do if they're new in the game is they'll do everything as much as they can. And only when they hit a breaking point, they'll say, okay, let me start systemizing what I'm doing because I can't handle everything. And it might be, you know, a lot of people have come from an employee background, myself included, where I was doing everything from creating a model to doing outbound calls to like creating slides. You're doing so much stuff, most of which is kind of unnecessary for you, but that's just the game. That's like pretty much how it's always been. And then you get into business and you realize, okay, that's actually not the way to make real assets. But the way to make real assets is you just do the one specialized thing, systemize everything else. And it sounds like you could do that from day one. You don't have to wait until you've hit a cap. You could just start implementing that ASAP.
You should start implementing that. Often the first hire that I recommend is an administrative assistant because they can take off of your plate all the stuff that is not that critical.
Yeah.
Stuff that, you know, and then you can do the stuff that's mostly just critical stuff. And so it ends up, as you build an organization, I call it everybody plays at the top of their game. Mm-hmm. Which means people only do the stuff that just requires their ability. And anything lower than that, you hire off to somebody who's usually lower priced, needs less training. And that person is now playing at the top of their game. Mm-hmm. It's not grunt work for them, but it would be grunt work for you. And so you end up expanding the whole operation. And it becomes much more cost effective. And you give better service to the customers too.
Yeah. So John, here's one thing which, you know, I hear this a lot, especially in businesses. Hey, play within your zone of genius. What's your superpower? Like there's all these buzzwords around that. And for me, I've always wondered, well, how do I figure that out? I feel like I could do a little bit of everything because that's the nature of how I started the business. Like, I don't know what I'm the best at. It's really tough, right? I wish someone could just say, hey, Neil, just only do this and automate the rest, but it's not that easy. How do people find out what that zone of genius should be?
I hate those buzzwords.
Yeah, same.
Honestly.
It feels like straight out of a business book.
Yeah, it's like a bumper sticker. It's kind of true all the time for sort of everybody, but it's meaningless or it's useless. Let's put it that way. You know, it's like, how do you succeed in the stock market? Well, you buy low and sell high. Oh, gee, thanks.
Easy.
And so the real way to do it is, first of all, get into a business, make a profit, get something going, and then start looking at all those different pieces. And what I say in the output thinking book is we start talking about the outputs that individuals make. And I've come up with 6 or 7 different kinds of outputs and different criteria about them. Then I say, okay, which is what we've talked about, how do those outputs get produced? Ideally, they get produced with a repeatable, scalable system. The next step is, How do you look at the company as a whole? And because any company will have dozens, some of them hundreds of subsystems when you start breaking it down. It gets way too big to keep in your head. But if you think of the company as a whole, all the systems produce outputs that fall into what I call seven buckets. Mm-hmm. One bucket is making whatever the customer wants to buy, product or service. I call that serving the customer. That's the serving bucket. And there's lots of different subsystems into that, like in your world. Well, like I said, you have to clean a place. You have to have the equipment to clean the place. You have to have the supplies to clean the place. If you have a crew, you need a crew team and a crew leader for the crew. You need a scheduler. All that's subsystems around serving the customer. Then there's a whole bunch of subsystems around selling, the marketing, the closing the deals, the proposals, all that. Those are the two main ones. Then there's four systems that support the making and the selling. Mm-hmm. And those are hiring people, managing people, all the people stuff. Then there's all the money stuff, collecting money, paying the bills, getting the financial analysis that tells you what the money, all this insight that the money has. There's an information bucket, which is making sure that people have the training, the access to people who can help them make decisions, that kind of stuff. Then there's a bucket that I call CAFE, which is a list of things that you just have to pay attention to. Otherwise, you screw up when they get in trouble. It's like going to the dentist or getting your blood pressure checked. It doesn't really help you run a marathon, but if you don't do it, you can be in trouble. So, and CAFE stands for compliance, administrative support, facilities, and et cetera. There's about six or seven other stuff. And then the seventh bucket is scaling. These are the outputs that go into growing the company, which are strategy, plans, goals, KPIs, that kind of stuff. So long way of saying, if you look at the company as those systems, every company, even, you know, the first thing that one person does needs all of those to more bigger or lesser degrees. Mm. Then you can start saying, which of those can I outsource next? How big do I have to get to where I don't have to do the HR function or the bookkeeping function or this other stuff? You can't ignore the bookkeeping. You can't say, well, I'm not going to do bookkeeping until I get to be $100,000 a year business. You'll never get there.
Yeah.
But you don't have to spend 40 hours a week on it when you're small.
Yep.
At some point, somebody needs to spend 40 hours a week on it.
Yeah.
Probably not you if you're the boss, but somebody's doing it. And hopefully you'll get big enough to where you need somebody full time for that.
Yeah. I think the overall summary is outsource what you hate doing first. And then whatever's left over is probably the stuff you hate doing the least. And that's probably what you want to focus on. So simple way of looking at it.
Yeah. To a point, you want to make sure that you don't, when you outsource what you hate doing, you run the risk of ignoring it. And that's somebody says you're abdicating, not delegating.
Yep.
And that can be a problem.
Yeah.
It's definitely something you don't want to do all the time, which is, you know, that happened to me. I love building companies. I love understanding how the business model works, what makes them tick. I hate doing the repetitive management day to day to day. And yet that needs to be done. And so you can't ignore that, but you can hire people to do it for you. As long as you understand it. Don't just get rid of it because you hate it. Understand it first and then get rid of it.
Yeah, definitely. John, tell me more about CEO Bootcamp and the offer you currently have for that.
Yeah, so after I moved away from my company and it was 1,500 miles away and I owned it for 25 years, it didn't take as much time. And so I got into coaching. And the CEO Bootcamp is the name of my coaching practice, where I work with business owners one-on-one to help them systemize their organizations. And if you go to my website, ceobootcamp.com, you can learn a little bit about what I do. And there's a link for a free coaching session if people want to take that. And I promise you, it's not a sales pitch, maybe a little bit at the end, but it's not a sales pitch. It's actual coach. My goal is that you will walk away from that session with something you value, even if we never speak again.
That's awesome. And I'm going to put the link to the website as well as the booking link for John directly in the show notes. So feel free to take a look at that.
Great.
And John, thanks so much for hopping on, man. That was awesome.
My pleasure.